Thank you for tuning in to the Israel Podcast, Episode 9, The Dreyfus Affair, Part 5. In this fifth and last episode of the series, we covered the end of the affair and the happenings of the Dreyfus family in the years that followed Alfred Dreyfus's second trial. In the last episode, we left off right after Captain Alfred Dreyfus's second guilty verdict. His brother Mathieu helped secure him a presidential pardon, fearing he will not last more than a few more months in prison in his current health. While he was now to be released from prison, Alfred did not feel that his name was sufficiently cleared, and neither did some of his greatest enemies. Everything amused me. Everything interested me. It felt as if I had returned to life after a long and horrible nightmare. This is what Alfred Dreyfus wrote of his train journey home. He was sitting in a train compartment with his brother and nephew/bodyguard and was heading towards La Rochelle. French security agents were sitting in a neighboring compartment. His last voyage through the region was in a prison wagon, pelted by rocks. Now he was traveling in the opposite direction and first class. He was savoring his newly gained freedom and could finally begin to relax. The rest of the entourage, however, was preparing for trouble. When the train arrived at Bordeaux at 4:30 p.m. on September 20th, and the party had to leave the train to wait for their connection east, crowds began gathering, and the chief of security feared a violent demonstration. While the security chief continued to lose his head and imagined a massacre about to take place, Alfred remained calm. No troubles actually developed, only isolated shouts of "Down with Dreyfus" and "Long live Dreyfus," and they were on their way again. Dreyfus, having read about the technological improvements of the time in the science journals that he had received on Devil's Island, was now seeing them through his own eyes. Different modes of transportation were now competing with horse-drawn carriages. The telegraph and the telephone, although established prior to Alfred Dreyfus's arrest, have finally become commonplace. He must have also been aware of the controversy surrounding yet another new technology, the cinema, and specifically an 11-reel movie entitled The Dreyfus Affair by the pioneer filmmaker Georges Méliès. After studying photographs and sketches, Méliès, who had built the world's first film studio, restaged the principal events of the prisoner's case and of his life in exile. Dreyfus was heading towards his sister's house. He chose his sister's house in Carpentras, with its mild autumn and winter climate, its clean air and good memories of the past, as the ideal retreat after 5 hellish years in prison. There's no record on Alfred's and Lucy's first night alone. The couple remained silent on the subject, and there would obviously be no need to record it in letters. The next day, the family brought 8-year-old Pierre and 6-year-old Jean to meet an anxious Alfred. He was worried that the children would be shocked by a father who had become, a stranger to them. Pierre would later recall this meeting as one of his earliest childhood memories. He remembered seeing his mother next to a man with white hair and clothes which floated on his thin frame. The man seemed wary, but he looked at us with such emotion that we returned his kisses and immediately welcomed him as our papa. Alfred later wrote that the instant the children threw themselves into my arms, they made me forget so much sadness, so much sorrow. After reuniting with the family, Dreyfus turned back to the affair. Dreyfus wanted to be reinstated in the officer corps, but could not do so until new facts emerged to reopen his case and secure his acquittal. He was pardoned at Rennes, but not rehabilitated. And as soon as his health permitted, he planned to resume the legal battle. But it would be a long, long while before he had the strength. He could not walk more than a few hundred meters, and on many nights his malarial fever returned, and he hallucinated that he was still trapped on Devil's Island. Many veterans of the affair made their way south to meet the man they had defended. The first visitor was Dreyfus's first ally outside the immediate family, Commandant Fosinetti, the prison director, who had risked his career to support Alfred's cause. The visits of family, friends, and allies continued through the fall and winter. But these were not to reminisce about the past. These were meetings that focused on strategic planning for the future. When the French government proposed amnesty for all criminal acts or misdemeanors connected with the Dreyfus affair, the family was outraged. Mathieu called the planned legislation shameful, wretched. The legislation meant that Mercier and his co-conspirators would escape the punishment they deserved, and that the family would find it virtually impossible to uncover the new facts needed to pursue the case. Dreyfus filed his protest immediately upon hearing the proposed law. "The project deprives me of my most cherished hope, that of seeing my innocence legally proclaimed. I have solicited no indulgence. The right of an innocent man is not clemency. It is justice." But preparations for the legislation in the Senate continued. Though his fevers and nightmares persisted, Dreyfus slowly regained his strength. Given the dangers involved, he rarely ventured beyond the boundaries of his sister's estate. He still did not have the freedom to walk along the city street with Lucy and the children, to visit parks, shops, or theaters. It was time to move. But the family's options in France were limited. So Dreyfus set off to Switzerland. He stayed in a villa on Lake Geneva near the village of Cologny and a 20-minute walk from the center of Geneva. Unlike the French, the Swiss left the family in peace. Through the spring and summer of 1900, the Universal Exposition was exceeding all attendance and revenue forecasts. The threatened boycotts never materialized, and the World Fair pushed the Dreyfus affair further into the background. The Dreyfus move to Geneva started rumors that the captain had given up the fight and feared for his life. His supporters back in France found it increasingly difficult continuing the fight with Alfred Dreyfus relaxing on the shores of a Swiss lake. With Alfred no longer in exile, and with the officers who had conspired against him about to be pardoned by an amnesty law, the case no longer inspired the passion that once done when Zola published J'accuse. Prime Minister of the time announced to the chamber, "The Dreyfus affair is over." The proclamation, what Dreyfus called later a lack of moral courage, caused Dreyfus to announce that the Prime Minister, and I quote, was mistaken when he said that he had seen the last act played out. He had seen only the next to the last act. In the aftermath of the exposition, the Dreyfus family were on the way back to Paris to keep the case alive. In the spring of 1901, Dreyfus published a book detailing his account of the affair, presenting a selection of letters he had written to Lucy and to government officials from Paris, prisons, and from Devil's Island. He hoped to remobilize support for the final revision of his case. "Cinq années de ma vie," or 5 years of my life, enjoyed immediate success in France and in many translations around the world. wanting to avoid any appearance that he was out for profit rather than for an essentially moral goal, Dreyfuss had asked his publisher to publicize the book only briefly and with dignity. His duty, as he put it in the preface, was to tell the story of the 5 years when I was cut off from the world of the living, from the events in France which remained unknown to me until the trial in Rennes. While anti-Semitic press greeted the release with their predictable slurs, undercover agents had exposed a plan to kidnap Dreyfuss and put an end to his affair. Jules Girard, founder of L'Action Nationale, a publication that had fallen on hard times, thought that a sensational kidnapping would increase his readership and assembled a gang of anarchists and past and present members of the Anti-Semitic League of France. They carefully studied Dreyfuss's routines and then planned to kidnap him after smothering with a cloth drenched in chloroform. The plan was to take him by car to a secret location and hold him there until all attempts to reopen his case were abandoned. If they were not, police evidence suggested, Dreyfuss would be executed, French Revolution style, decapitated, and his head shown to the people. The director of investigations was sent to alert Dreyfuss, and police sent guards to protect the family and their visitors. In the meantime, the fight for revision continued. One very elusive piece of evidence that might have appeared in the deliberation room of Rennes and that had long hovered in the shadows of the case was the original sheet of paper from which the bordereau had been traced. Never seen, but always rumored to be the single most dramatic document of the affair, it allegedly contained annotations by Dreyfuss's main contact across the Rhine, the German Emperor Wilhelm himself. Dreyfuss's enemies believed that the general staff kept it secret for reasons of national security, while Dreyfuss's friends call it the fake of fakes, one of the many pieces of counterfeit evidence fabricated in the back rooms of the état-major. After the elections of 1902, the political landscape in France changed. Many of the newly elected assembly no longer needed to be convinced of the captain's innocence. But they did need new facts from which to launch the final revision. On April 6, 1903, in the French Assembly, a socialist deputy exposed the secret role that the imperial forgery had played in the affair. General Louis André, the new Minister of War, addressed the Assembly and agreed. The political climate, however, had merely shifted. It had not been reversed. The Assembly ended up voting down the motion for an inquest, leaving the Minister of War to pursue his own personal investigation. Nearly 10 years after Dreyfuss's arrest, General André and his associates sifted the evidence for over 7 months before presenting their findings to the Minister of Justice. They never located that mysterious bordereau, but they uncovered the two letters from the Italian military attaché to his German counterpart that Colonel Henri had altered. The judges of the criminal chamber announced a public hearing, and through the spring and summer of 1904, all the players in the affair who had not yet died or fled for cover returned to the witness stand. Dreyfuss had faced his first court-martial in a state of shock after a nervous breakdown on the day of his arrest. 5 years later, he faced his second court-martial weakened beyond belief by his stay on Devil's Island and fighting malaria and dysentery. At both trials, he could not adequately contribute to his defense. By 1904, however, he has regained much of his strength and has mastered all the details of his affair. In June 1904, with the Criminal Chamber's preliminary investigation nearing its end, Dreyfus asked permission to be heard. After a 40-minute address to the court, he ended with the following statement. "It is I who have pity for those who have dishonored themselves by condemning an innocent man through criminal means." We'll take the bureaucratic machinery of the United Chambers of the High Court of Appeal 2 years before reaching its final verdict. After a dozen years, two trials that had reshaped the political landscape of France, triggered riots, and placed the existence of the Republic in danger, a wave of indifference greeted the hearings of the High Court in June and July 1906. Most of the witnesses for the prosecution, who met with success in 1894 and then again in 1899, had been exposed as dupes, liars, frauds, madmen, or just simply misguided defenders of military honor. The judges of the High Court of Appeal voted to annul the verdict of the Rand Court Martial and rehabilitate Alfred Dreyfus. At noon the next day, the chief presiding judge read the formal verdict in the Palais de Justice. For more than an hour, he revisited the principal events, people, and documents of the case, focusing on the forgeries and on the bordereau, and confirming that, and I quote, "no referral to further adjudication is in order." The judgment was final. Over the days that followed, Alfred Dreyfus settled into his study and wrote to the widow of Emile Zola and to other supporters, and noted in his journal that he had, and I quote, "never doubted the triumph of justice and truth." His faith in France had been unshakable. The High Court's verdict reinstated Dreyfus's civil liberties, and now the Minister of War set out to reestablish the captain's military rights and privileges. Given his accomplishments over the years prior to his arrest, Dreyfus would have been promoted to major by 1901. And if his exemplary record had continued, he may have become a lieutenant colonel as early as 1903. But the minister recommended Dreyfus's promotion only to major. Worried that the military high command and its parliamentary supporters would tolerate only so much indulgence. The captain's reinstatement was a political necessity, but definitely not a cause for celebration. Realizing that at his age of 46 and in his condition, he would never attain the high rank that he had always been striving for, Alfred decided to remain in the army for 1 year. He wanted to prove to his critics that he could serve effectively. He may have been stunned by the injustice of his promotion, but he was heartened by the announcement that he would be named a Knight of the Legion of Honor. The Council of the Order of the Legion of Honor approved the award unanimously, and preparations were made to knight Dreyfus on July 21st at the École Militaire, only steps from the site of his degradation. Many wanted the ceremony to take place in the Grand Cour Morland, on the precise spot of the captain's degradation. It would be a powerful statement of rehabilitation, a closing of the circle. And the Minister of War, more generous with symbols than with promotions, Agreed. But Dreyfus, afraid that the memories would overwhelm him, refused. Called from a room off the courtyard at 1:30 p.m. Dreyfus came forward, his head high, his pace rapid. From second-story windows looking out on the Corps des Jardins, family members, reporters, and photographers watched Dreyfus pass two batteries of artillerymen and two squadrons of cuirassiers. His very pale face turned a sudden feverish red. In the heavy silence that followed, as he stood at attention before the commanding officer, his thoughts took flight and the memories returned. His heart raced and he began to sweat. He had to call on an immense effort of will to hold himself upright. When a colonel called out at ease, Dreyfus, alone among the soldiers in the courtyard, did not move. The sound of trumpets finally wrenched him from his painful dreams. Brigadier General Guillain, a senior officer in ceremonial dress, turned to Dreyfus. In the name of the President of the Republic, and by virtue of the powers invested in me, I name you Chevalier of the Legion of Honor. He lowered his sword to Dreyfus's shoulders three times, pinned the cross on his black tunic, and near tears embraced Dreyfus, saying, "I am happy to have been charged with the mission I have just accomplished." The new Chevalier of the Legion of Honor responded with words that echoed those he used nearly a dozen years before. "Long live the Republic! Long live truth!" Photographers captured those final moments. Dreyfus, with sharp pains in his chest, asked to be taken home. In the fall of 1906, after taking up his duties as artillery commandant, Dreyfus decided to appeal for his promotion to lieutenant colonel. If the problem were not rectified, he would retire, because, as he put it, he could no longer tolerate, and I quote, "the feeling of being bypassed for having spending 5 years on Devil's Island." It was a difficult decision for a man who had always wanted to be judged on his merits, but it was made more difficult by the fact that his petition had to be submitted to a new Minister of War. The new government named Georges Picard, Minister of War. Yep, that's right. Same anti-Semite Picard from the affair. Picard's appointment created a personal and professional dilemma for Alfred Dreyfus. In late November 1906, Dreyfus met Picard at the minister's office on the Rue de Saint-Dominique. They met at a neighboring room to the one they met in October morning 12 years before, when Picard had led the captain to that first eventful meeting and interrogation with Commandant du Parti de Caen. Besieged with requests for Dreyfus's promotion, not only from Dreyfus, the general dealt with his junior officer as if he had come to plead for special dispensation. Dreyfus, on the other hand, tried to convince the minister that the promotion was warranted, given his years of service. But Picard ignored the petition and rejected the appeal. For Dreyfus, retirement would mean the end of a long period of unease over his place in the military. Dreyfus wanted to forget in calm all the sadnesses of the past and be born again to life. He submitted his request for retirement based on seniority and did not, he made it clear, tender his resignation. He was retired at the lower rank of captain with a pension of 2,350 francs for nearly 30 years of service. and with no compensation for his time in prison or in exile. His immediate superiors, however, unlike the Minister of War, closed his dossier with a glowing report, citing his excellent conduct, wide learning, and very lively intelligence. They called his years in the military worthy of praise, and added that despite his age, he was, and I quote, perfectly suited to render the finest service to the artillery or to the general staff as a major or lieutenant colonel in the reserve. In the event of war, the report concluded, Alfred Dreyfus would be assigned to the military command. A few years earlier, and on the day following Dreyfus's revision, the Chamber of Deputies had voted to move Emile Zola's remains from the Montmartre Cemetery to the Panthéon, the grand repository of French heroes. Delayed by nationalist protests and French bureaucracy, the transfer was finally approved 2 years later, in the spring of 1908. The novelist and defender of Dreyfus would be interned near Voltaire, and the event would be marked by a celebration at the Place du Panthéon, only a few steps from the École Polytechnique. Alfred Dreyfus would attend, and he would be surrounded by old friends in a familiar locale. Meanwhile, in weeks prior to the ceremony, the Action Française condemned Zola's proposed Panthéonization and encouraged its followers to protest the government's profane act. Zola's widow received anonymous threats from young patriots who warned her that if her husband's ashes went to the Panthéon, a bloody drama would ensue, and his remains would end up not in the nation's sanctuary, but in the sand. Late on the morning of June 4th, Armand Fourier, the president who had signed Dreyfus's revision, approached the Panthéon along the Rue Soufflot. Two lines of soldiers stood between the president's carriage and a large crowd of students shouting, "Down with Zola, down with Dreyfus." Prepared for trouble, police arrested demonstrators who refused to move on, as well as a handful of young men brandishing knives. When the Minister of Public Education finished a speech honoring Zola's devotion to France, an army band struck up a familiar chant. Rising to join, Dreyfus suddenly heard a gunshot. As he turned, he glimpsed a revolver pointed at his chest and instinctively raised his right arm for protection. A second shot pierced that arm before the assailant was wrestled to the ground. A physician hurried Dreyfus into a police station nearby and treated the wound. The muscles of Dreyfus's arm had been severed, but his movement in self-defense had deflected the otherwise would-be fatal bullet. 66-year-old Louis-Anthelme Grégory, a former playwright, had probably acted on his own, though he must have been aware of the bounty on Dreyfus's head. During the trial, held in September, Gregory's lawyers attempted to reopen the Dreyfus case by repeating old rumors about the captain's alleged confession of his crime. But after 14 years, two court martials, and a final revision, the Dreyfus family would have none of it. Having learned from previous mistakes, Alfred Dreyfus addressed the court in a strong and harsh voice and stood up in anger to remind the lawyers that the High Court of Appeal had already proclaimed his innocence. The jury acquitted Gregory, just suggesting that his act was not premeditated and had been prompted by blind devotion. The newspaper Gaulois announced the day after the trial, "Gregory's courageous attack struck Dreyfus in the arm. The verdict struck Dreyfusism in the heart." during the period that followed, police received more strong rumors of plots by young royalists to kidnap Dreyfus. February 1909, a gang of 60 thugs invaded the family's apartment building, shouting, "We must have the Jew." They reached the elevator, which they vandalized before they were finally chased out. On the steps of the Pantheon, Gregory's bullet had narrowly missed Alfred's children. And after the assault on the apartment, Alfred sought security for his family. He returned to Lake Geneva and resolved to devote the rest of his days to his children. Pierre would later recall his father's kindness during those years, but he would also describe the oppressive ambience which weighed upon us all. Dreyfus seems to have been obsessed by the need to separate his public agenda from his private life. He taught the children only the vague outlines of the case, and once told, the story was rarely repeated. Pierre was a diligent student and showed an aptitude for science and mathematics, like his father. And by his 11th year, he was ready to enter a Paris lycée. Later on, Pierre Dreyfus, with his baccalauréat in hand, entered his father's former school, the Collège Chaptal, where he concentrated on mathematics and modern languages, and prepared for the entrance examinations required by France's Grande École. As the son of Alfred Dreyfus, Pierre would surely be subjected to the same harassment if he tried to follow his father's footsteps. Pierre therefore hoped for a career in industry. In September 1910, at the age of 19, Pierre passed the entrance examination and accepted by a Grande École, like his father, on his first try. After 1908, to avoid the requirement that they declare citizenship in the German Reichsland, Mathieu's children, Emile and Magui, now teenagers, left Mulhouse and moved back to the house in which they had spent most of the affair. In France of the early 20th century, the dreams of reunification with the eastern provinces were still very much alive. The dreams of revanche, French for revenge. That dream of reunification applied to the Dreyfus family as well. The family was running two separate industries, Raphael Dreyfus's original factory and the branch managed by Jacques in Belfort. The division of those enterprises reflected the forced separation of the family itself, and part of their definition of revanche included the hope of one day consolidating the Mulhouse and Belfort mills under common French ownership. In 1911, Mathieu lost a partner who had helped him maintain the family's first enterprise in Mulhouse. Léon Dreyfus's death at the age of 57 was probably the result of a stroke. Jacques Dreyfus sent his older sons, Charles and Maurice, to take over Léon's responsibilities. With Jacques approaching 67 and Mathieu nearing 54, the time had come to prepare a new generation and to name the heirs apparent. While the family would continue to share the profits of Raphael Dreyfus' company, Mathieu's son Emile and Jacques' son Charles would preside over the factory's reinstatement as a French enterprise at the hour of reunification. While fulfilling his compulsory military service in 1912, Emile announced that he planned to make the army his life. Mathieu, though disappointed that Emile would not succeed him in the family business, supported the choice and spoke of the special obligations. "Because of the name that you carry, your duty is even more exacting than that of your comrades," Mathieu wrote. But later, after pressure from family members, Emile pursued a career in industry instead. Meanwhile, Mathieu's daughter, Magui, married her childhood sweetheart, Otto Reinach, Joseph Reinach's son, and the two of the most prominent families of the affair were united. Though retired, Dreyfus had been in the Army Reserves and working on studies of troop mobilizations in the region north of Paris. Recognizing that in wartime the majority of combatants would be drawn from the reserves, he advocated a short term of active service coupled with frequent reserve exercises and the development of an extremely well-prepared career officer corps. A general staff, in other words, with more knowledge than that of 1870 and more integrity than that of 1890s. Late in the morning of June 28th, 1914, in the Bosnian city of Sarajevo, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the Crown Prince of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, succumbed to the bullets of a young assassin. The Third French Republic, committed to join Russia in the event of war, and fearful of a German invasion through Alsace-Lorraine, prepared to mobilize its military. On July 28th, Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia. And for the 72 hours that followed, the hope of localizing the conflict in the Balkans faded away. A few hours before the assassination, Germany had sent ultimatums to France and Russia, demanding that those powers suspend mobilization plans. On August 1st, the government of the Third Republic informed Berlin that France would act in accordance with her interests. On the same day, Germany declared war on Russia. Posters appeared throughout France calling for general mobilization, and the country was making the final preparations for war. The Dreyfuses and Reinhardts prepared as well. Mobilization meant a rapid return to Paris. Anticipating the call to arms, Otto Reinhardt had left a pregnant Maggie and their two children in a small Breton port town where they were vacationing. 23-year-old Emil Dreyfus, a civilian for less than a year, rushed to rejoin the 32nd Artillery at Fontainebleau, while his cousins, Jacques Sans, enlisted in Belfort. Still in uniform, Pierre Dreyfus awaited orders at a garrison in the east. Worried that he would miss the mobilization of reserve officers, Alfred took the night train to Paris with his daughter. Almost 55 years of age, Commandant Alfred Dreyfus received his orders on August 2nd. He was posted as an artillery officer in the fortified zone north of the capital, near Saint-Denis. Almost 20 years earlier, he wrote his family from Devil's Island. "When I am finally leading my brave soldiers again, I will forget everything. The sufferings, the tortures, the outrageous insults. May God and human justice make that day come soon." That day came on August 3rd, 1914, when Germany declared war on France. On the evening of August 7th, 1914, Pierre Dreyfus joined 14,000 other soldiers from Belfort and prepared for the invasion of Mulhouse. Two nights before, bayonets fixed, those troops had chased a German brigade from the nearby town of Altkirch, and Pierre, having fought with courage in that battle, had been promoted from corporal to sergeant. At 6 p.m. on August 8th, French cavalry rode through the streets of Mulhouse, and after drawing sniper fire from doorways, windows, and roofs, forced a retreat of German units and cleared the way for the 7th Corps. Pierre Dreyfus entered Mulhouse along the same road that his grandfather had taken from Rixheim 80 years before. Marching down the Rue de Sauvage near the Rue de la Justice, he passed the apartment in which his father had been born. And he helped secure the city's northern periphery in the shadow of Raphael Dreyfus and company on the Rue Lavoisier. "Children of Alsace," began a proclamation by General Joffre, posted in Mulhouse and distributed throughout France on the morning of August 9th. "After 44 years of painful waiting, French soldiers are marching again on your native soil. They are the first workers in the grand task of revenge. What emotion for them, what pride. The French nation unanimously urges them on, and in the folds of their flag, the magical words of law and liberty are inscribed. Long live Alsace, long live France." On a troop train near Verdun, Emile Dreyfus, preparing for his own grand battles, closed a letter to his mother with the exclamation, "Long live Mulhouse, long live Alsace." On another train near Troy, Ado Reinach applauded the glorious brigade from Belfort, which included Dreyfus's in its ranks. Along with Pierre, he was referring to Jacques' sons, Charles, Maurice, and René. To the west in Paris, Commandant Alfred Dreyfus felt profound emotion when he learned that Mulhouse had been liberated. "Our confidence is boundless," he said. And though he knew that a grand conflict against the enemy would follow, he had, and I quote, "the firm hope that this marked the beginning of an era of victory." Like the entire high command, however, he was wrong. French troops held Mulhouse for barely 48 hours before German units took it back. After securing reinforcements, the French retook the city and raised the tricolor, but Germans tore it down a few days later and reestablished control in the wake of fierce house-to-house fight. Over a two-week period, the French lost 300,000 soldiers and nearly 5,000 officers in the Battle of the Frontiers. And by late August, the general staff learned that it had played directly into German hands. The French high command had hoped to stage a lightning push through Alsace-Lorraine and across the Rhine, sending 800,000 men straight towards the eastern frontier. But the Germans followed their own pre-war plan, devised by the military strategist Count Alfred von Schlieffen. After invading the neutral Belgium in early August, German armies swept into France and turned south toward a lightly defended Paris. French armies rushed to protect the capital along the Marne River, but among the troops called back across the Vosges were Sergeant Pierre Dreyfus and his cousin Emile. Pierre engaged the enemy only a few kilometers from his father's military post near Paris. Ado Reinach felt disappointed that he could not join his Dreyfus in-laws on the banks of the Rhine. And as a symbol of both his frustration and his dream, he changed the name of his horse. "I have rebaptized her," he wrote his wife, "and called her Mulhouse." On the night of August 30th, the lieutenant returned from a mission as a liaison officer to find his company decimated, in disarray, and leaderless. The Germans had attacked a short time before and had pulled back to a small wooded area nearby. Ado immediately took command and ordered his men to secure an abandoned farmstead near the village of Fossé. And then, on his horse, Mulhouse, his armor breastplate and high plumed helmet making him an easy target. He charged with more than a dozen troops into the neighboring forest. Given the darkness and the confusion of battle, the few corsairs who made it back to the farmstead could not confirm if their lieutenant had been shot or taken prisoner. He was never seen again. On March 27, 1915, in the apartment she had shared with Ido in Paris, and in the midst of a bombardment by German Zeppelins, Maggie Dreyfus Reinach gave birth to her third child and first son, Jean-Pierre. A few days before the baby's birth, Maggie's eldest uncle, Jacques Dreyfus, suffered a stroke at his home in Belfort and died. It was shortly after he was notified of the death of two of his sons. Second Lieutenant with the 32nd Artillery, Emile Dreyfus, had fought close to his cousin Pierre at the Battle of the Marne. French armies and the British Expeditionary Forces had halted the German march on Paris and had destroyed the Schlieffen Plan. For Emile, Pierre, and thousands like them, the campaign at the Marne had signaled the end of a brief war of movement and the beginning of a long war of stagnation. A war that was supposed to end by Christmas and include huge armies sweeping across vast battlegrounds turned to a battlefront of trench warfare, running from the North Sea to the Swiss border. For Second Lieutenant Emile Dreyfus, as for Sergeant Pierre Dreyfus, in trenches not far from each other, the most notable victory during those months was survival itself. Pierre, still awaiting his first leave, had taken part in nearly every major campaign since the outbreak of the war. From Altkirch and Mulhouse to the Marne, Soissons, the Oisy, and the Aisne. Pierre's father, Alfred, still served as a commandant in the fortified camps that protected Paris. Lucy and Jean were doing volunteer work in Paris hospitals for the Red Cross. And Jean's fiancé, Dr. Pierre-Paul Lévy, a major in a military hospital, had requested ambulance duty at the front. He wanted, family reported, a dangerous posting. After a summer lull on the Western Front, Commander-in-Chief Joffre tried to break the stalemate with another major offensive by French and British troops in Artois, and simultaneously by the French alone in Champagne. 35 divisions, nearly 500,000 men, massed along the front, Emile and Pierre Dreyfus in the ranks. The Champagne landscape was only relatively flat. The Germans controlled the heights of its gently rolling hills. Breaking through the first enemy line, French armies did not have the artillery to reach the second. And a brief battle of movement gave way to another episode of bloody trench warfare. In the final weeks of September, with French armies under intense bombardment, the high command sent down the order: try again, whatever the cost. On September 27th, after 3 days and three nights of directing artillery fire from a forward trench, Emile Dreyfus was struck by the shrapnel of a German shell. It tore into his skull in four places and exposed his brain. But when gunners carried him back to the main trench, he was still alive. Hours later, Mathieu, his wife Suzanne, and their daughter Maggie left Paris for the field hospital where Emile was being treated. The only civilians permitted to enter that war zone, they drove across fields pockmarked by artillery shells and finally found Emile in a large hut on the outskirts of a French encampment. Nearly motionless on a stretcher, as Mathieu described the scene, and with most of his face obscured by bandages, Emile had fallen into a partial coma. He regained consciousness and recognized his family amidst the groans of 20 other wounded soldiers and the whistling of German shells above. Suzanne Dreyfus nursed her son. She remained at Emile's side for 15 days. Shortly after the family's arrival, the commandant of the field hospital announced that Second Lieutenant Dreyfus had been named the Knight of the Legion of Honor. In a solemn bedside ceremony, with the medical officer pinning a medal on his patient's hospital gown, Emile Dreyfus became the second member of his family, after his uncle Alfred, to be awarded the Legion of Honor. A few days later, Emile's condition deteriorated. The family received permission to stay in the field hospital throughout the night, but a downpour of German shells scored a direct hit and violently hurled Susan and Magie to the ground. Covered with debris but unhurt, they were evacuated to bunkers nearby. In a cold, wet, and suffocating bunker, a few meters underground, Suzanne placed her winter coat over her son. When enemy attacks continued, an order came to move the wounded to another field hospital. The next morning, the Dreyfus family were ordered to leave the war zone immediately. 2 days later, on October 22, 1915, Mathieu Dreyfus received a telegram in Paris that read as follows. Your son has just died peacefully, never having regained consciousness after your departure. Another official communication carried the signature of the French commander-in-chief, citing Emile Dreyfus's bravery and initiative since the outbreak of the war, and describing his noble attitude under fire. Second Lieutenant Emile Dreyfus, a Chevalier of the Legion of Honor, had been awarded the Croix de Guerre with Palm. In a handwritten memoir, destined for his grandchildren, Mathieu recalled those October days and the cavalry charge 14 months earlier when Lieutenant Reinhardt disappeared. My dear children, he wrote, think often of your papa Adon and your uncle Emile. They were two beautiful spirits. Let the example of their lives always sustain you and always encourage you to do good works. And you, Jean-Pierre, Mathieu wrote the boy who had never known his father and could not remember his uncle. I'm certain that you will be, like them, an honorable man, a brave Frenchman. And if the fatherland ever calls on its children again, you will do your duty as they did theirs. Pierre Dreyfus, recently promoted to second lieutenant, received permission to visit and embrace Emile before he died. He arrived in time and stayed long enough to arrange a temporary marker in the military graveyard nearby. The slaughter in Champagne to Camille Dreyfus and 145,000 other Frenchmen. Serving as special assistant to Colonel Gotzmann, artillery commander of the capital's northern fortified zone, Alfred Dreyfus directed the mounting of cannon and the preparation of other armaments sent to the front, and help inspect the ring of trenches that protected Paris. His thinning hair and thick mustache, now almost completely white, the 56-year-old officer remained in surprisingly good health and full of spirit. He felt much more rehabilitated by his active army service, said a friend, than by the official judgment of the High Court of Appeal. In early September, with Germans massing only a few kilometers to the east, and with enemy airplanes dropping leaflets on Paris, French government decamped to the port city of Bordeaux. Alfred Dreyfus wanted to move beyond the secured outskirts of Paris and take part in combat. Maintenance of the 50-kilometer ring of trenches and artillery posts around the capital required constant work, but it was a monotonous life compared to the battlefront. Dreyfus waited with great impatience for the order to move forward. His superiors, however, concerned about his health and probably worried about rekindling anti-Dreyfus protests within the army, denied his request to serve at the front and delayed his promotion from cavalry major to lieutenant colonel. On January 26, 1916, at a town hall near Champs-Élysées, 22-year-old Jean Dreyfus married Dr. Pierre-Paul Lévy, a former physician in a Paris hospital and now an army medical officer at the front. Pierre did not make it to the wedding. He was far to the east of Paris, in Verdun, a region of strategic irrelevance but of historic importance. To lose Verdun would be to sacrifice a historic symbol of French defense. And in a war that had degenerated into murderous struggles over a few meters useless territory, the symbol of Verdun became somehow a political priority for both French and Germans. The chief of the German general staff, Erich von Falkenhayn, chose the town not for a battle of cavalry charges and decisive forward movement, but for a calculated war of attrition. The code name for the operation left no doubt about its goal. Gericht, they called it, a place of judgment. The essential question is not to take Verdun, Falkenhayn announced to fellow officers, but to pin down the French, pull them towards the battlefield, and since they will have to defend it shoulder to shoulder, we shall bleed them white by virtue of her superiority in guns. On February 25th, while Pierre Dreyfus's unit and others in the immediate area held their ground under fierce attack by cannon, flamethrowers, and machine guns, German troops took the key fort of Douaumont. Moving to a position between Douaumont and the village of Vaux, Pierre directed reconnaissance operations and attempted to coordinate the activities of isolated units. While most troops in the Verdun sector served an average of 8 days at a time, Pierre Dreyfus remained at his post for 21 days. Military reports confirmed that he refused to be relieved of duty, and after the first onslaught in late February, he did not want to jeopardize the continuity of service during a critical phase. And while the heaviest shelling of the long battle continued through March, the second lieutenant stayed with his battery and directed the fire of its guns. under continuous enemy bombardment. His superiors cited the second lieutenant for his distinguished service in the most perilous conditions since the outbreak of the campaign. Having entered the war as a corporal, Pierre Dreyfus would soon be promoted to lieutenant and given command of his own platoon. Finally released from the inferno in Verdun in the midsummer of 1916, Pierre Dreyfus moved to a relatively calm sector at the foothills of the Vosges. Falkenhayn's Gericht lived up to its name, though two nations, not just one, were bled white at that place of judgment. French casualties numbered 500,000 men, and German losses reached 400,000. And all for a stretch of land that had little importance when the campaign began, and even less importance when it ended. Having endured the battles of Mulhouse, the Marne, Oisy, Champagne, Pierre Dreyfus had now survived the worst of them all. Within a few weeks, however, he would return to the front lines and to a conflict that rivaled Verdun in its strategic senselessness and the scope of its destruction. Pierre traveled northwest to the Somme. Near his brother-in-law, Pierre Paul Lévy, who treated the battle wounds in one of the sector's field hospitals, Pierre Dreyfus served for 44 days at the Somme, engaged in almost constant fighting and dangerously exposed to German attack. He received his second citation for courage under fire. Allied armies pushed no more than 7 miles into the enemy front at the cost of 420,000 British and 200,000 French troops. Germany lost some 500,000 soldiers. The combined casualties of Verdun and the Somme totaled nearly 2 million men. Pierre Dreyfus had survived the most horrific campaigns of 1914 to 1916. His service had been distinguished, but so too had that of Emile Dreyfus, Otto Reinach, Jacques' two sons, and countless other men who gave their lives on the battlefield. By 1917, all but 4 soldiers from the Dreyfus and Reinach families had been killed. Only Alfred, Pierre, Jacques' son René, and Rachel's son Louis still served, along with their new in-law, Pierre Paul Lévy. Commandant Alfred Dreyfus finally realized his goal of joining a combat post in February of 1917. He helped direct munition depots near the Aisne River and later in the western sector of Lorraine. The general staff may have worried about anti-Dreyfus protests when they assigned the commandant to the front, but those concerns must have been outweighed by the pressing need for officers of any age in the aftermath of Verdun. Alfred Dreyfus, 57 years old, arrived at the front as an enthusiastic artillery officer. Appreciating his first opportunity to work with soldiers directly engaged in combat. Both Alfred and Pierre survived the Nivelle Offensive, a campaign that led not to rapid victory within 24 hours, as the general had promised, but to the loss of nearly 200,000 French troops within a matter of days. For the first time since the outbreak of the war, French troops had risen in protest. The direct, although delayed, response to the trauma of Verdun, and more immediately to the Nivelle system, the mutinies of 1917 involved more than 30,000 soldiers. Many of them refused to return to the firing line under the conditions that had reigned for nearly 3 years. In that late summer of 1917, Alfred and his son met for a few hours in the town of Epernay, where they dined together before Pierre headed back north toward the Verdun sector and Alfred returned to his original post near Paris. Along with exchanging news about the family and the troops they commanded, they must have talked about America. The United States Congress had declared war on Germany in April, and the first soldiers under the command of General Pershing were finally arriving. After the disastrous Nivelle offensive and the recent staggering losses suffered by the British at Passchendaele, the promise of young, healthy troops from America gave the Allies new hope. By 1918, the German assaults had slowed, but the Flanders fields on which Pierre fought at the head of his unit in May 1918 must have seemed no different to him than the forests of Champagne or the plains of Verdun. When the High Command celebrated the American victory at Belle Wood and felt the first flush of confidence that Germany would be routed, Pierre engaged the enemy in the worst combat he had known since the outbreak of the war. At some point in May or early June, Army medics rushed Lieutenant Dreyfus to a hospital in Caen, near the Normandy coast. He had been seriously stricken by poison gas. But after barely 6 weeks of recuperation and a visit from his father, he returned to the front on July 21st. Sent back to the Champagne region, he rejoined the 7th Corps to drive German units east. And in late August, he approached the site of his first major battle in the western hinterlands of Alsace back in 1914. After directing artillery fire from a forward post and securing crucial reconnaissance information for his group commander, he received his third citation for courage in combat. A few weeks later, on November 6th, General Foch met German representatives in a railroad car in northeast of Paris. And 5 days later, at 11 a.m., on the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, an armistice was signed. Pierre Dreyfus fought with the 10th Army until the final hours. And on the eve of the armistice, he received his 5th promotion since August 1914. Entering the war as a corporal, he left it as a captain. Wearing the Croix de Guerre with palm, and as part of a regiment awarded a special military commendation. Pierre's father, Alfred, approaching his 60th birthday, also earned a promotion that was way overdue. For having fulfilled his duty since the day of mobilization, with keen intelligence and fine spirit, the excellent superior officer, Alfred Dreyfus, became a lieutenant colonel. French officials also upgraded Lieutenant Colonel Alfred Dreyfus from chevalier to officer of the Legion of Honor he had received in the wake of his affair. Jean's husband, Pierre Poilievre, had also been decorated for bravery and received commendations from both the French and Italian armies. On November 17th, 1918, French soldiers greeted with flowers paraded down the streets of Mulhouse. And a month later, Prime Minister Clemenceau, proud to be the last survivor of those who had signed a protest against the treaty relinquishing Alsace-Lorraine in 1871, attended yet another grand patriotic festival in Mulhouse. Alfred and Pierre could not leave their units to witness those celebrations, but Mathieu and Suzanne came with Maggie and her three children to represent the family and to honor the memory of its men lost in battle. The return of Mulhouse and the eastern provinces had taken 4 years, and the sacrifice of more than 1,300,000 French soldiers. Three Reinhardt children donned playful costumes for the Mulhouse parade. But their mother and grandparents all dressed in black. After the war, and now that Emile Dreyfus was gone, Mathieu's grief had taken its physical toll. Mathieu no longer had the energy to oversee an industry which, for him, lost its raison d'être. Consulting Alfred and his sisters, he decided to sell the cotton mill founded by their father 60 years before, and the branch factory launched by Jacques in the 1890s. In the spring of 1930, just short of his 73rd birthday, Mathieu suffered a minor stroke. A second stroke followed in the early summer, and a few weeks later, while recuperating, he was struck by a third and massive attack. Suzanne arranged for an ambulance to rush her husband to Paris. Partially paralyzed, Mathieu developed pneumonia, and on October 22, 1930, on the same day of his son's death, 15 years before, Mathieu died in his home. Adhering to every wish recorded in her husband's brief handwritten testament, Suzanne Dreyfus had Mathieu's body taken directly to the small Passy cemetery near the Trocadero. A few years earlier, Emile Dreyfus's remains had been brought to the cemetery from the military graveyard at Mormelon-le-Grand. No flowers or wreaths draped Mathieu's coffin. No eulogies were given. Held in the strictest intimacy, the service included only one participant outside the family, a rabbi, that gave a short and simple prayer, and he gave it following Mathieu's strict instructions in French. On the night before the burial, family members had gathered at the apartment close to the coffin. And in a voice barely audible to others in the room, 71-year-old Alfred said goodbye to the brother who had saved his life and restored his honor. "Je te dois tout," he whispered to Mathieu. "I owe you everything." Following and passing years could not eradicate the tortures of Devil's Island. Alfred's nightmares, the sudden shrieks that jolted him awake from dreams of double buckles, armed guards, and spider-infested cells persisted more than three decades after that exile. The stoop of his shoulders had become pronounced, and he walked with a cane. On the streets of Paris, he would only be recognized by the occasional old ally or enemy who had known him in person. One exception was an employee at his bank, another decorated veteran of about the same age, that always greeted Alfred with respect. They had first met nearly four decades earlier as prisoner and guard on Devil's Island. On a summer trip to Switzerland in 1934, Dreyfus fell ill and was hurried back to Paris. Following emergency surgery, he developed uremic poisoning. For a long year, wrote Pierre, he suffered horribly. Pierre came to visit him every day, and on Thursday, July 11, 1935, his 75-year-old father took his hand and held it in silence. The next afternoon at 5 o'clock, Alfred Dreyfus passed away. On Sunday morning, July 14th, 1935, mounted troops sporting the high-plumed helmets and armor breastplates of another age rehearsed the drills they would perform a few hours later for Bastille Day. At the same moment, Alfred Dreyfus's funeral procession set off on its way to the Montparnasse Cemetery across the Seine. It was to be a simple religious service, attended only by the immediate family and by a rabbi. En route to Montparnasse, the Dreyfus procession traveled down the Champs-Élysées, and as it passed through the Place de la Concorde, cavalry troops stopped their maneuvers to observe a sacred military ritual. 36 summers before, soldiers had turned their backs in the presence of Alfred Dreyfus. But on Bastille Day, 1935, they turned their horses to face the black hearse passing by, not knowing the identity of the man they honored. They raised their swords in a silent salute of respect for the dead. Well, I guess that's it for the Dreyfus affair. To be honest, I didn't think it would take 5 episodes. I also originally thought I would focus on the pivotal role it played on the emergence of Zionism. But I guess we'll cover that in future episodes on Herzl, the Hungarian journalist that witnessed the degradation. Again, most of the research is from the great book by Michael Burns, Dreyfus, A Military Affair. I think the book does real justice to the personal story that may sometimes be overlooked. I certainly overlooked it until reading this book. I will leave a link to the book in the show notes, or you could simply visit theisraelpodcast.com/episode009. Thanks for listening and checking out the Israel Podcast. I hope you tune in next time for another episode.